This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from the record of Master Dongshan. When Dongshan was leaving his teacher, his master, Nanwan, said, "Make a thorough study of the Buddha Dharma and broadly benefit the world." And Dongshan said, "I have no question about studying the Buddha Dharma, but what is it to broadly benefit the world?" Nanwan said, "Do not disregard a single being." This weekend, as many of you know, we did our annual Dana dinner, in which we make a day of offering of food and gifts and sangha to folks in the community many of whom may have not a lot of options in terms of their lives or how they spend the holidays. And so it's a way to open the doors for people who may not be interested in Buddhism, but are interested in sharing a day together, and a way for us to give, to practice giving. Week before, I gave a talk at the Union Seminary in New York. They're doing a series on emptiness and social action. And I was asked to be one of the speakers. And in that, somebody asked a question that stayed with me afterwards. Not so much the question, but my response, because afterwards I wasn't really happy with the way I responded. And so it sort of kept with me. And so this talk, in a way, is responding to my response. The question was basically, in this, the subject of emptiness, which is the essential teaching of Buddhism, and how to understand that, both what is emptiness — emptiness is a word — what is it in truth, in reality, and what is its relationship to life, to living, to action, to relationship, in this case, social action, specifically social justice and forms of injustice. In other words, how do we manifest the Bodhisattva path in a real way? And so every morning we chant, "Form is emptiness and emptiness is form." And this is the great immeasurable reality of the Buddha Dharma, this fundamental teaching, this radical revolutionary teaching. But in being a fundamental truth of Buddha Dharma, that's just another way of saying it's a fundamental truth of life, of reality. That's all Buddha Dharma is, that it's an essential aspect of our mind. Form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. Make a thorough study and realization of Buddha Dharma. Realize the fundamental emptiness. And broadly benefit the world. Do not disregard a single being. Bring that forth into the world of differences and people and situations. Canon Bodhisattva realizes mind. All beings are one essence. Realize the fundamental nature of all things as being empty of permanence, of self, of soul, of eternality. And she awakens the heart. Nothing is forsaken. How do you manifest selflessness in a world of trouble? Sentient beings are numberless, without measure, beyond comparison. I vow to alleviate the suffering of all beings, not abandoning a single one. broadly benefit the world. This teaching is difficult to realize. It's much more difficult to actualize. Despite the fact that in every single moment we are embodying that very truth, that that is our basic nature. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form, is everything, every instant, every time. And so we practice letting go of the self into, we might say, wisdom. And we practice giving that selflessness into compassion. They're not separate paths. That's why we, in practice and training, it's happening all together. There are practices that turn our attention towards realizing emptiness. There are practices that turn our attention towards manifestation, manifesting. Ultimately, they all have to be realized as unified. And actual training is designed to do exactly that. The course of training is designed to do exactly that, to help us to fully understand and bring forth that essential teaching. Form is emptiness and emptiness is form. And so we have the practice of Dhanaparamita, selfless giving. Giving, which is ancient and everywhere, right? That is not a uniquely Buddhist practice or action. But Dhanaparamita, giving as wisdom, as the wisdom of prajna, is what makes it a paramita. Giving, arising out of that wisdom of selflessness, manifesting selflessly in giving. Self and other are not two. The self ultimately gives to the self. Master Dogen, in his fascicle in the Four Methods of the Bodhisattva, says when a person who is embodying giving goes into a room where there are other people, those people take notice. I think what he's really saying is that the power of that mind of giving communicates itself. Right? Not just in the act of giving, but that that mind is itself giving and is perceived. It may be conscious in our perception, it may not. You know, if this is hard to imagine, flip it around. When a person walks into the room who's very bound within their own greed, bound within their own stinginess, bound within their isolation, do we take notice of that? I think so. He says, know that the mind of such a person communicates subtly with others. And what I wanted to concentrate on is how do you help someone? The Bodhisattva path based in alleviating suffering of self and other, realizing self-nature of self and other. And other here means every other. People, creatures, inanimate objects, situations, time, policies, ideas, beliefs, anything that we can relate to on any level. To alleviate the suffering within every single object. And so how do we do that? How do you help someone who doesn't want to be helped? How do you serve someone who rejects what you're offering them? How do you love someone who is filled with hate? Maybe that hatred is turned towards you. How do we be generous with somebody who's greedy? How do we see the Buddha, the perfect nature, the perfect, unproduced, uncreated nature within someone who appears as a demon? How do we forgive someone who has hurt, caused harm? How do we affirm the one who is denying? In a way, a place like this is as easy as it gets. Really. Because we all choose to come here, right? So it's a self-selecting group. I mean, we're all making the choice. You know, although sometimes we forget that. And that means that we are all, each of us, in our own way, you know, in our own place, on our own path, has decided or is in the process of deciding or exploring whether we want to decide to the way in which and the degree to which we want to turn towards making a thorough study of the Buddha Dharma and broadly benefiting the world. And so we're already turning in this direction. There's already an inclination. And at every step along the way, there's the teaching and the practice and the constant reminder and just recognition that we are here to take responsibility for ourselves and our lives. And so that makes all of this possible. It doesn't make it always easy, because we do forget. And even when we remember, it's still difficult, because the conditioning otherwise is so deep. But that there still is this general inclination in the same direction. It's like when you're watching, you know, a field full of Canadian geese, and they're all pointing towards the same direction, right? The sun, the light. And so many other situations are not like that. And so how do we turn outward towards all of those many beings who live in all of the realms, the hell realm, the hungry ghost realm, the animal realm, right, the realms of the angry gods, the prideful gods, and people, and not abandon them? How do we turn inwards towards those many beings inside that we would abandon and forsake? And so to speak of emptiness, of selflessness, of non-attachment to someone who is deep within their own sense of fixedness, of otherness, of grasping, of righteousness, would generally not be very helpful. And so how do we broadly benefit the world? I wanted to draw from a teaching of Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna was one of the pivotal figures within the history of Buddhism, particularly Mahayana Buddhism, arriving very early, 150, 250 in the Common Era, so fairly early on, and was really the beginning of the Majjhimaka school, which is a very important development of Mahayana Buddhism that is very prominent within the Zen tradition, within the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. He's said to be the beginning of the Prajnaparamita teachings, which are so, so important. And so he's really the central figure. And the nice thing about this text is that much of Nagarjuna's teaching is very difficult to understand. And here, this is a treatise on the provisions for enlightenment. So he's really talking about the Bodhisattva path. So he's sort of showing his lighter side, if you will. And so in that, Nagarjuna says, in your relations with beings, as a bodhisattva, you should not allow yourself to forsake those many beings. As befits the abilities determined by your own powers, you should always strive to draw them in. Strive to draw them in. And to not allow ourselves to forsake them. Which is very simple, but also very important, because we realize that's a choice we will make, we do make. We can choose to forsake and abandon someone, or we can choose not to. We cannot allow ourselves to do that. In the same way that we can't allow ourselves to do that. That's how powerful we are. And to draw upon the powers that we have. And so he's saying, use what you have. Draw upon them. When in the Vimalakirti, Manjushri at one point asked Vimalakirti, this great enlightened lay adept, what should the bodhisattva do when we become terrified by life? What do I take refuge in when I'm terrified by life? I look outwards and I encounter something and it's frightening. What do I do? Where do I turn? Where is my power in that moment? And Vimalakirti says, take refuge in the magnanimity of the Buddha. Take refuge in the generosity, the expansive heart of the Buddha. Magnanimity is not petty, right? It's not bound up in things that are not important. It's large. It's the essence of generosity itself. Take refuge in that very generosity. What an interesting, all the different things Vimalakirti could have said, all the different ways that one might respond to that question. What do we do when we encounter fear of life? And he says, take refuge in the magnanimity of the Buddha, of your nature, as befits your abilities, determined by your power. And so that's part of the Bodhisattva practice, our practice, is to develop our powers. Right? And that's a tricky word in English, right? Because we so often equate it with power that is not used well. You know, the power to dominate, the power to oppress, the power to control, the power to fulfill greed, anger, and delusion. But if you think of it as energy, as befits your abilities determined by the different ways in which your energy, your understanding, the way you manifest yourself, the way that appears. And so we can think of that as our life experience, what we've learned, the skills we've developed, the skills of our careers, the skills that we've just picked up along the way, the things we've learned, the knowledge we've acquired, our mindfulness, attention, patience, the ability to listen, the ability to not judge, to have courage, to step forward when there's an impulse to pull back, but we step forward. These are some of the powers that we have. And the commentary on this says, thus, even when people behave abysmally, we should refrain from forsaking them. Rather, we should persist in encouraging them to cultivate giving and moral virtue. So how do we help oneself? And we should think of this both inwardly and outwardly. How do we help ourselves when we act abysmally? Don't forsake yourself. Don't give up on yourself. Rather, encourage yourself and others, when you're working with others, to cultivate giving. Because giving is a fundamental practice. It's a spiritual practice. To give means you have to recognize you have something to offer. And to offer it, you have to let go. And to give means we have to be in relationship to someone or something, which means we're not isolated and cut off. And it's a language everybody understands. And it's something we can do. We can actually do it. You can even do it when you don't want to. Right? And that way you can make yourself give, which really just means choose to give at the same moment that you're wanting not to give. You make that choice to give larger, a little bit larger than the impulse to not give. We can do that. It's amazing. To draw them into the path, to draw ourselves back to the path. And he says, from the very beginning, the Bodhisattva should accord with the power of your own abilities and use skillful means to instruct beings, causing them to enter into the great vehicle, into Prajnaparamita, into the truth of the Buddha Dharma, which really means just the truth of this life. So this is not just for Buddhists. And so in that sense, we're always acting within the place where we are. We're not trying to be something we're not. Right, we're using the powers that we have, that we've cultivated, that we're developing, But we're also trying to expand on those, develop them further, not become complacent, not stop growing. Because when we stop, when we become complacent, we become less, more, we become less skillful, less able, less powerful. And the shift here is that rather than just developing those skills or those powers for our own benefit, now we have a much, much greater motivation, a much more urgent need, which is everyone, everything. The Gurdjieff says, instructing through resort to the Shravaka vehicle or through resort to the Pratyekabuddha vehicle is undertaken where, on account of lesser abilities, beings are unable to accept instruction in the great vehicle. So what he's talking about here is the Mahayana tradition, the great vehicle, and the recognition that people are attracted to the path with different motivations and will proceed differently. And so the Shravaka and the Pratyekabuddha are two different sort of inclinations that other practitioners have, other people of the path have, understood from the Mahayana perspective, that is basically geared towards self-liberation. You know, so we all come into practice with that as a motivation. We all want to relieve our own suffering. We all want to experience our lives in a different way. Those two paths, from this perspective, are sort of singularly motivated by that. Not so concerned about everybody else, but really just wanting to find peace within one's own life. And so he's saying, when we encounter someone, or when we ourselves are in such a place that we're not able to sort of take in the possibility of making our lives that large, of broadly benefiting the world, of not abandoning a single being, that then we may need to practice or guide another, meeting them in that place where they want to be free. But it's, at this point, just for them. But they do want to be free. And so he says, so meet them there. We can do that. And that's not false dharma. From the Mahayana perspective, it's smaller. That's why it's considered a smaller vehicle. It's a smaller motivation. It's a smaller liberation, in a sense, because it's not encompassing the whole universe. It's not yet prajnaparamita, because it's not fully non-dual, fully unified in the realization of form is emptiness in every possible manifestation of that. And then it's not ultimately liberating, because our lives fundamentally are fulfilled in service to others. And so what he's really saying is, meet people where they are. Very simple. Meet yourself where you are. We can do that. And the fact is, I mean, I remember when I first came here, and I was definitely being motivated by my own life and what I wanted that to be and my own pain. And from the very first time I sat in this hall and listened to my teacher, and he was talking about the precepts and compassion and the bodhisattva vow, and I saw his mouth moving, right? I heard the words. I understood the words he was saying, but I didn't really hear him. Then in my mind, I kind of just put that aside. I remember when sitting downstairs in what's now the common room, after I'd been coming for a few months, and I told him that I wanted to be a monk. And so we had a conversation about that, and he was sort of talking to me about what that meant. And he was talking about really being making my life in service to the Sangha and to others. And I remember in my mind thinking, And I don't remember exactly how I framed it, but it was sort of like, I'll probably be able to get around that. Right? So I could see that this was important to him, that somehow this was important to the Dharma, but it wasn't important to me yet. Not in that way. I couldn't hear it. I wasn't ready. I didn't want to hear it. Because I saw it as, quite simply, putting others before myself. And I thought, I'm just not ready to do that. There's just too much of me in front to squeeze in anybody else. And honestly, I also thought, how could I? How could I be of help to anyone else when I need a bit of work? I couldn't conceive of it. So Nagarjuna says, where even when relying on a smaller view, the Shravaka or Pratyeka vehicles, in addition to the great vehicle teachings, so in other words, even then, you know, when we come down to just a personal liberation perspective, there are those who still cannot accept any instruction, even there. He says, so now strive to establish within them merit-creating situations. And so this is where, in Buddhism, creating merit is extremely important and is a way of basically doing good works, which creates positive karma, but builds up what is called merit, which is essentially creating a conducive environment within yourself and externally that will allow us to actually realize liberation. And that if we don't do that, if we don't sort of build up that conducive environment, mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually, meditationally, but also in our lives, we have to clean up our lives, right? And not just by not creating harm, but by doing good things, right? Bringing forth good, that we're creating what in Buddhism we call merit, which is basically building up a sort of a storehouse, a momentum that we can then practice from within and cross over to the other shore. And so he's saying when a person can't hear the Dharma, then help them to create those conducive environments. So he says, for those delighting in cyclic existence and who abhor a life devoted to achieving spiritual liberation, in other words, they're not only can't hear it, they don't want to hear it. He says, you should establish in them practices associated with the four measurables, associated with compassion, kindness, loving kindness, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. In other words, we're not talking about Dharma here, but just what can we do to bring forth compassion, to bring forth aspects of loving kindness, to bring forth aspects of generosity in the sense of, you know, being able to hold and appreciate other people's good fortune and good qualities and not feel like we're being diminished, and to encourage equanimity. Then he says, where not even this is possible, then just try and encourage the 10 paths of the path of the 10 good types of karma, which basically relates to our precepts, wholesome actions. Not killing, not stealing, not lying. So just encourage that person, ourselves, to basically try and not create a lot of trouble. Right? To stop creating trouble. He says, if this is not tenable, then just encourage them to give. Just encourage them to practice giving. And one way we can do that is by giving. By being an example of giving. But what's so interesting about this is we're working our way through, right? All the different possibilities, all the different beings that we encounter within ourselves at different moments and in others, in which there are different doorways of opportunity, there are different possibilities, different mind states. And within this vow to not abandon a single being to broadly benefit the world, we have to deal with a whole smorgasbord of beings, right? So we can't just think, well, you know, we're dealing with Buddhists or we're dealing with people who, you know, think like I do. And how do we stay in it? Because otherwise we will abandon. Then he says, if there be persons unable to accept instruction conducing either to heavens or to liberation, favor them through bestowing present life benefits. Then, as befits one's powers, try to draw them in. So he says, for beings, the commentary says, for beings who are exclusively dedicated to desire-based pleasures. Know anybody? Have you ever been that person? Exclusively dedicated to desire-based pleasures, who have no sense of retribution, cause and effect, right? No awareness, no concern for action and consequence, who are seemingly bound for not good futures, right? You can see where this path is going. It's not a good path. And who are unable to take on the teachings conducive to something larger, something more life-affirming, something more magnanimous. He said we should still feel pity for them. Now, pity is a feeling of sorrow and compassion, and arises out of the experience of suffering and misfortune in others. And it comes from an old French word, compassion, etymologically. And we can use this in such a way, and the precepts point to this, that we sort of elevate ourselves and feel sorry for somebody else. We sort of put them in a diminished role. We see them as a diminished person. And it elevates our sense of ourselves. That's not what he's talking about. That's not the pity that he's talking about. He's talking about genuine empathy, the pain that we feel when we see someone else's pain. It's not because it's morally virtuous. It's not because you're supposed to feel that. You just feel it. It's because we're in contact. We allow ourselves to allow that person's suffering to enter us. And then we experience our own suffering in relationship to their suffering. And so he's saying to feel pity is to feel that pain, which is not their pain, but it is in relationship to their pain. And what does that do? It keeps us in contact. We are in contact. We have not forsaken this person. We have not abandoned them, because the only way we can experience that is in relatedness. It's like Vimalakirti is saying, the reason he was sick and that all the Buddha's disciples needed to go pay a sick call was because he felt he was sick because all sentient beings were sick. He felt he was suffering because all sentient beings are suffering. That's a real thing. So the grief that we feel at what's going on in our world, at what is happening in our planet, is happening in our neighborhood, is what is happening within our government, in a sense, is the heart, is the place of that pity, which is, again, not separating ourselves, but quite the opposite, bringing us into contact and keeping us connected on some level. And then he says, instead of using giving and other skillful means appealing to their present life priorities, we use pity so that somehow they might slowly be attracted to the path. In other words, within that experience of our own pain, because we're still in contact, now what might we do? In a sense, we've exhausted all of these other opportunities to more directly, tangibly, overtly help. Now what is possible? It's a very interesting question. And what it's doing is so the answer might be, I don't know. I don't know now what I can do. That's an honest answer. But we can't know what is possible unless we allow ourselves to get to that place. And we can't get to that place if we don't keep the door open. In that, it's like beginner's mind. In that, things remain possible. It's like going back to that question. Now, from that place, what power do I have? When the person has not just shut the door, and so now you're trying to reach them through that closed door, but they've moved to the other side of the country. Or they put earplugs in. Or they've turned their back. Or they've considered you a non-person. Now what can we do? And what is it when that person, that being, is a political party or an institution or a business or a government or a policy? What is studying the Buddha Dharma thoroughly and broadly benefiting the world? What is form is emptiness, and emptiness in form is form. To see that within a party, a government, an institution, a policy, there is no thing. There's only the coming together of minds, thoughts, ideas, views, objects, buildings, histories, and the creation. And the creation, and the creation, and the dissolution, and the dissolution, and the dissolution. There is no essence, and there are people who are wielding power, who are acting out of their karmic causes and conditions, who from within their own view, just as within our own view, what we do makes sense. Even when we know it's wrong, we do it because it makes sense to us. Delusion makes sense. That's why it's so hard to not be deluded. Not only does it make sense, but it seems to work. It seems like that's how we got here. And because it seems to work, we're very reluctant to give it up. Because if I give this up, then what will I use? Don't know. Don't know. You don't need to know that yet. When we know that this path is no longer a viable path, that's when we start to find out. The commentary says, there is no rationale condoned by the Dharma that justifies our abandoning another person. It's interesting. There's no rationale. In other words, there's nothing in the Dharma that makes abandoning another person make sense. Which is another way of saying there's nothing in our nature that supports that as a way of being in harmony or gaining happiness or finding fulfillment or avoiding suffering. The other way of saying that is that our very nature, in a sense, can only be realized, can only be brought to full fruition through being a benefit in the world. And so here again, it's not just because it's morally right, though it is, or because it's the right thing to do, that it is, but it's because it is our very nature. You know, it's sort of like trying to ignore the laws of thermodynamics. You know, like that if you don't keep putting energy into a system, that system will come apart. Well, I just don't believe in that. Right? I have a different philosophy. Well, that's very nice. Right? Maybe someone would like to hear about it. I'm not that interested, but that law is going to win. It's winning in every moment, right? And we will see that that's true the moment we stop putting energy into a system. Actually, what I just said, I'm not interested, that's abandoning. Right? And Nagarjuna points to that. See, that's how quickly it happens. And I didn't make that up. Right? That was just an honest display. He says, draw them in through giving, through explaining the Dharma, through listening to them discuss the Dharma, or through endeavors that are just beneficial to them. These are skillful means that can attract them. And the commentary says, as means to attract beings to the path, we can give gifts, we can accept gifts, we can speak about the Dharma, we can listen to other people talk about the Dharma, engage in beneficial actions, speak in a pleasing manner, take up joint endeavors, do something together, explain specialized fields of learning, right? Discuss something that you share in common or that they might know that you want to find out about. Teach special skills, manifest as engaged in the same livelihood. In other words, just be creative. Find different ways of staying in contact. One of the first times I had what I felt like was an intimate encounter with my father, who could never relate to the life that I was living before this and in this, was when I called him up one day. I was the bookkeeper, and we were putting in a new financial system, and I wasn't trained as a bookkeeper. And so I was figuring it out as I went, and he was a businessman. So I called him up, and I said, Dad, I have questions about finances and about spreadsheets and ledgers and stuff. And he was like, it was like, I've been waiting for this my whole life. And I hung up the phone and I thought, oh my God, I just had the most connected experience my father I've ever had. And we were talking about finances. And I realized for the first time I entered into his world. As his son, I kept thinking, you got to enter into my world. Dude, right? Want to know about my world. You should be finding out about my world. And he kind of didn't have those skills. And so accidentally, I stepped into his world. And it was as though he had just been waiting. And all of that generosity that he had was suddenly offered. Another commentary says, we might wonder how listening to someone discuss the Dharma makes sense when these individuals don't understand the Dharma. Reasonable. He says, but in doing so, this allows the Bodhisattva, you, to precisely evaluate their conceptual errors regarding the Dharma. In other words, it allows us to understand where is their mind. And in understanding the Dharma here, just understand that largely. In other words, where are they at? How does this person see things? He says it helps us to engage amicably with the speaker on that subject. In other words, it's not so much even about what we're talking about. It's just that we're able to be in contact in a way that is good. And to indicate personal respect and concern for that speaker, no matter how skewed their views might be. How appropriate is this today? And that can be very difficult when we experience another person's views as toxic, as dangerous, as hateful, right? As unviable. But if we remember, those views make sense to that person the same way that our views make sense to us. Same thing. We have the same experience. That what's really happening is we're just trying to find a way to stand on the same ground. To recognize that we are related. We have something in common, this world, this life. And so what I think is so simple and so extraordinary is that within this most profound teaching form is emptiness and emptiness is form. This most profound vow to live our lives as being a benefit to others, where we do not abandon a single being. How quintessentially and profoundly practical it is. Do whatever you can. Meet on whatever ground it is possible to meet. Because that's just a moment. And what Nagarjuna understands, what the Bodhisattva understands, is that's one moment within a whole arc of a path, of a life. And that if something happens in this moment, that becomes a seed for a possibility for another moment. And so a simple gesture, ordinary actions, using something, doing something together, talking, having a conversation, giving somebody a gift, handing somebody some money. Jimon and I were walking down the street the other day, and someone came up to us, a woman came up to us. We were over in Catskill, another town. And this woman came up and told us a story about how she couldn't get in her apartment and she needed some money just to wait. It was a whole story about how she needed some money. And so I gave her the money. I gave her some money. And we walked on. And I was sort of ruminating on that. And Jimon could see that I was thinking about it. She said, "What are you thinking?" And I said that I just gave her the money. And she said, "What do you mean?" And I said, "I missed that." I walked away feeling like empty, like that something had not been fulfilled. And I realized that I just did what she asked me to do. Or maybe I didn't really ask what she was asking. I just gave her the money. I didn't see it as an opportunity to do anything more, like just have a moment's conversation. That's how large and that's how immediate this practice is. And you know, those moments which come and go so quickly, those simple, ordinary moments, and in which we may meet it, and we may not, are all important. They're all valuable, right? Because even when we miss a possibility, an opportunity in that moment, in a sense, it's not over. That moment's never going to happen again. That person we may never see again. But there is someone else close at hand who is still on this path and can learn, can benefit from that moment that may have fallen short in some way. To really take that up, how do I thoroughly study the Buddha Dharma and broadly benefit the world? How do I not abandon a single being? So I'll end with a poem. As winter gives vistas to mountains, and summer gives birdsong to breeze, so too is giving in breathing, and kindness in seeing. Ignore this truth, and the fire shifts from orange to hot red. Living in this truth, you already know. Every day is a good day. So may we allow ourselves to take seriously this Buddha Dharma. And to the extent that we think we do, that's true. And there's more.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma Talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.